Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, Vice Presidential candidate and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz introduced himself to the country. He began with a personal story about how fertility treatments made his family possible.
If you've never experienced the hell that is infertility, I guarantee you, you know somebody who has. And I can remember praying each night for a phone call. The pit in your stomach when the phone had rang, and the absolute agony when we heard the treatments hadn't worked. It took Gwen and I years, but we had access to fertility treatments. And when our daughter was born, we named her Hope. Hope, Gus, and Gwen, you are my entire world, and I love you. I'm letting you in on how we started a family because this is a big part about what this election is about. Freedom.
Governor Walz also focused on the highlights of his progressive record.
We got right to work making a difference in our neighbors' lives. We cut taxes for the middle class. We passed paid family and medical leave. We invested in fighting crime and affordable housing. We cut the cost of prescription drugs and helped people escape the kind of medical debt that nearly sank my family. And we made sure that every kid in our state gets breakfast and lunch every day. So while other states were banning books from their schools, we were banishing hunger from ours. We also protected reproductive freedom because in Minnesota, we respect our neighbors and the personal choices they make. And even if we wouldn't make those same choices for ourselves, we've got a golden rule. Mind your own damn business.
Joining us to once again discuss Governor Tim Walz's record is David Perry, a journalist and associate director of undergraduate studies in history at the University of Minnesota. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's so nice to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you back. So what did you think of Tim Walz's speech last night?
It was a lot of fun. I liked how he delivered it. You know, someone said with the same kind of emphasis as a coach. They've really leaned into this coach mentality, which makes sense. Though I, as a historian myself, think of him as a history teacher. But you know, he's saying run the ball, run to first base. You know, hustle every play in a very kind of locker room style. But thinking about locker room talk, right, and the different roles that language has played in the last 10 years with it being used as an excuse for Trump's horrific behavior, and here is a kind of an inspirational space for energy and team, you know, work as a team and be a good sport, but also mind your own business, right? It's a very different kind of voice, and it's a very different kind of voice than the other people just speaking last night. If you think about Josh Shapiro, with a very kind of eloquent, inspirational speech. You know, it's a very different, down-to-earth, exciting, high-energy, inspirational delivery. I was entertained that the crowd really wanted to go crazy, and he would give them about 10 seconds. They were willing to keep shouting, and then he'd just charge right ahead because he had an agenda, and he wanted to cover it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And then I guess the other thing that lots of people are talking about, but which genuinely moved me, was the reaction of his son, Gus, who we talked about the last time I was on the air, who has a nonverbal learning disability and has ADHD, and just his enormously emotional response to Gus and Gus's response to his dad and all the reading about the care that Walz has brought to his own family. I found it very moving.
You know, to that point, I was spending some time on social media last night, and a lot of people don't know about Tim Walz's son. And I just have to say there were some nasty things said on social media last night. And so I did some searching, And they did an interview with People magazine, actually, Tim Walz and his wife, Gwen. And they talked about Gus. They told People magazine about the nonverbal learning disorder. He has ADHD and an anxiety disorder. They said all conditions that they call his, quote, secret power. Can you talk more about this and why this is so important? Because I have noticed in the past couple of days that the convention has really highlighted people with disabilities, which has been refreshing to see.
Sure. And, you know, this is something that is really personal for me, as maybe some listeners who would don't know that I'm the father of a boy with Down syndrome, and he's autistic, he's nonverbal. And really my entry into any kind of life as a journalist came through my work as a father, before as a work with a historian. One of the first pieces I ever wrote was about Sarah Palin, who, like me, is the parent of a child with Down syndrome, in the year 2012. Ann Coulter called President Obama, used the R word as a description. There was a whole nother thing. That's when I first started writing for CNN about these kind of politics. So this has been something that is really deeply enmeshed in not just my personal life, but my life as a writer. So Gus has a nonverbal learning disability, which was not a term I knew about even just a couple of weeks when we spoke for the first time. It's a learning disability that is not about speech, that is not verbal. He is not nonverbal. My son is nonverbal. So it's kind of a weird diagnostic phrase. But he has learning disabilities related to all kinds of different things. Is getting a lot of support in schools and is doing great. He also has ADHD, which is something people are more familiar with. People are, I guess what I want to say is that the way that Tim Walz is talking about his son is really refreshing and is really very good. There was a wonderful piece I could recommend to people by Eric Garcia, who's an autistic journalist, works for The Independent, but wrote for MSNBC about what it meant for him as an autistic man to hear Tim Walz talk about his son with such positivity, and not in a kind of superficial, we're going to fix him and make him better, which is something that we still hear a lot, but about accepting him and loving him for who he is and seeing the strengths within his personality. I got to say, Democrats are getting really so much better at this. I remember in 2016 when Hillary Clinton released the first kind of ever comprehensive plan to support autistic people and then very comprehensive disability policy in 2016. It was a big deal. And it was a big deal that as a freelance reporter, I had trouble getting media outlets to care about. Hmm. And then in 2020, the person who released the disability policy, each one better than the next. But as it happens, the first person to release a comprehensive policy document about how, as president, they would support disabled Americans was Kamala Harris. And that's just, maybe it's just a coincidence, but it is true that she was the first of the candidates in that cycle to release a policy document. And everyone did. And they're really good and they're really detailed. And now here we have Tim Walz and his son Gus on the ticket, and lots of disabled people on stage. It's an inclusion of people with disabilities into the various, I don't know, maybe this is too academic, but the various kind of categories of difference that the Democratic coalition is based around celebrating, difference of race and religion and gender and sexuality. And these have been categories for a longer time that it's been important to our coalition to celebrate. But disability is a latecomer into that explicit kind of inclusion. And it's about time, and it's wonderful to see.
Wow. You brought up a number of things there. I, just like you, when you first mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago that Tim Walz's son, Gus, has a nonverbal learning disorder, I also thought that that means that he doesn't speak. So I looked it up also. And according to the Child Mind Institute, nonverbal learning disorder, it's referred to as NLD, is a learning disorder in which children have trouble with skills like understanding concepts, finding patterns, and organizing information. They also struggle to apply those patterns and concepts to new situations. When you think about how the media works, David, given that so many people, millions and millions of people saw Gus, if you didn't watch it, really find a video and watch it. He got up, he's crying when his dad walks up. He jumped up on his feet. He pointed at his dad and he said, "That's my dad. That's my dad." I mean, it really was amazing to watch. And I really hope that people do a little reading about this and learn about this disability, because I just haven't really heard it talked about much. And David, don't you think that's the role of the media? This is how things work. We're as journalists, we're exposed to something new, and then go write about it. Go ask politicians, what is your plan to improve the lives of people with disabilities? This is something that deserves so much more media attention.
And, you know, it's particularly important when it comes to these federal positions. I mean, I want every politician to talk about disability. It's the thing I do. And I've been working on this for a long time, but it is not a diagnosis I had really paid attention to until the last month. I'm glad to learn. And I hope that people who read what I write and other people write and are listening today are also glad to learn about it. But when it comes to disability, the federal government has just such a critical role. And in some ways, a unique role, in part because disability is something that we all, if we live long enough, we all become disabled. It's a sort of a category one can enter into and then leave again. But when one becomes disabled, and I'm using this word disabled very much on purpose, and I'm not talking about special needs. Tim Walz talks about it as his son's superpower, which is nice, and a lot of people do that. It's great. I don't want to use euphemisms. I want to say disability, because disability is a federally protected category, which comes with civil rights protections, which comes with access to legal and educational supports. It has a very specific kind of position in the federal government. And policy, you know, it's hard to sell people on caring about policy. But I got to tell you, in the disability world, it shapes lives and makes things possible. And, you know, for Gus, I mean, now, sure, he's the son of the governor, but when he started in education, he was just the son of a public school teacher who had access to good supports that when he was three, he would have got access to early intervention services, again, funded through the federal government or directed through the federal government, often funded through the states. These are things where when we elect officials, I, as the parent of a disabled child, have really specific questions, and their answers will shape what my son's life looks like now and also what's possible in the future. And that's true for just tens of millions of people.
I was just looking up some numbers. This is so interesting. I'm taking care of my dad right now, and he has a hard time walking for various reasons. That's a disability. I mean, so many people have disabilities. 42.5 million Americans with disabilities are in this country. That is a lot of people. So you mentioned Kamala Harris's disability platform when she ran for president the first time. Can you tell us more about that? And has she talked much about this in the last month?
It's really interesting. I don't think she's talked a ton about it in the last month specifically, although I'd have to dig around a little bit. It hasn't been a kind of a primary thing, but what she's done is exactly what you're talking about and what I really support, of folding disability into a broader conversations around caregiving, around aging, around healthcare. And that these are really important ways. There was a great, I'm thinking about kind of the media coverage. I love what 19th News does in particular around this. They hired and part of why I haven't done as much reporting on it, because there are these great disabled reporters now with full-time jobs doing wonderful writing. So as a freelancer, I've sort of moved on in some ways. But, you know, she has really focused, they called it the Mamala economy, right? Thinking about caregiving. And that's the key, because just like as we can move in and out of disability in our own lives, we can move in and about caring for people with disabilities or caregiving in all kinds of different contexts. My mother-in-law has just been diagnosed with serious cancer, and that's going to shape the next. I mean, you know, we get older, and these are things that happen. I'm not trivial about it, but, you know, I try to face these things. But, you know, this is going to shape our lives in the next 3 months to, you know, who knows how many years. And then it's going to change again. Mm-hmm. these are experiences we all have. This is a fundamental part of being human. And when it comes to our government, there are things they can do to make this better or worse, right? The human experiences are going to happen. The question is, are we going to be struggling to find the supports we need, or are we going to be supported? And I think that Harris is really very much talking about ways that government can make a difference, that good government is good, which is something that, you know, we saw Bill Clinton last night. That was not something that he was comfortable saying, talking about that government was good when he was president. he might now, right? The 90s are a very specific moment. Democrats are willing to say that life can be hard. It can be complicated. Things happen. But government can be there to be good, to be supportive. And that's what I want to hear.
This is so important. You mentioned the 19th. I love this news organization. They're an independent nonprofit newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. And I just read the piece that you pointed out, or I skimmed it, but I want to read one portion here. I think this is so important. In 2019, when Kamala Harris ran in the Democratic presidential primary, she crafted a platform centered on family issues. She proposed creating a 6-month paid family and medical leave policy, one of the most ambitious paid leave proposals Democrats have put forward. This almost makes me want to cry because this is my second really intense time of caregiving. And right before I came on the show, I fixed my dad a smoothie. The oatmeal is still on the stove because I just didn't have time running around, making sure the computer's plugged in. I mean, it's so hard. This is such hard work. Yeah. So that would be amazing to take 6 months off and be paid for it. And then, this is one of the most ambitious paid leave proposals Democrats have put forward, with a provision for chosen family that would allow LGBTQ+ parents as well as others to also take leave. It was far beyond the 4-week universal paid leave policy Biden included in his 2021 economic package that ultimately failed to pass the Senate. All right, we're going to find out who voted against that. We can guess, right? But I'm sure maybe some Democrats also did. This stuff is so important, David, and I just hope in the coming weeks that we find out, does Kamala Harris still support these ambitious plans? And then how is she going to pass them? Because she needs an overwhelming Democratic majority in the Senate, and she needs a Democratic House to do all of this.
Yeah, you know, we lost in the Build Back Better bill, which now seems like it was a totally different era, but was in fact 2021. It was really Joe Manchin that said this is too, that the caregiving elements were too expensive and pushed back against those, and they ultimately got dropped as a way of getting the bill across the table. So it is certainly, we should recognize that 50 Republicans were against it too. But there was at least one Democrat who just said it's too expensive. Not that it wasn't good, but that it was too expensive. This wasn't the priority. And I got to tell you, a lot of people in my communities remember that very clearly and would like to see a different outcome. But the other thing, I hope.
Yeah, David, real quick, was that Joe Manchin?
That was Joe Manchin.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I thought I said that. The other thing, though, is that, I hope that they control both houses of Congress and the presidency, and they pass lots of great stuff. I have a long list of things I'd like to see happen. But a lot of things can happen within the framework of the federal systems already. And it's really telling who President Obama was the first person to really put disability experts into his office. I think it's the Office of Public Engagement that he founded under Valerie Jarrett. Disabled people connected to the disability community, doing that kind of work, linking up with the folks who are looking at aging, linking up with the folks in healthcare. One of my absolute favorite people to talk to about disability in the law was one of President Biden's first early hires. I think he's the lead counsel for Health and Human Services, though he may have moved on. But there's a lot of people I know who have a deep, decades-long expertise working on these kinds of issues who immediately went to work for Joe Biden. There are Republicans who have this background. The American Disabilities Act was a bipartisan piece of legislation signed by the Republican George H.W. Bush. George W. Bush, in I think 2007, signed this very important the ADA Amendments Act, which basically, for listeners, included mental illness as a disability and covered by those things. It's a really important act. And it was bipartisan. There are Republicans who are out there who have this experience, but they are not the Republicans who are working for Donald Trump. And that's a real problem.
Hmm. You know, speaking of that, and I hate to do this, but people need to know, because the fact of the matter is anything can happen in November, because especially because of the Electoral College. And so there's two things that I think are really important since we're talking about disabilities, which is such an important issue. I want to read right now from the AFP Fact Check. So this is Agence France-Presse. And this piece came out last month. I'm going to read from this. Daniel Galgano wrote this. As Kamala Harris ramps up her White House campaign against Donald Trump, critics have shared a 2022 clip where she introduces herself in a meeting as a, quote, woman sitting at the table wearing a blue suit, end quote. Mm. But the full video shows the vice president addressing a group of disability rights leaders, some of whom were visually impaired, and multiple participants adopted the practice of offering a brief physical description. And the GOP is mocking her for this with no context.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing where when trying to be inclusive in any context becomes accused of just, the phrase they're using these days is being woke. When I was in college in the 90s, it was being politically correct. And I'm sure there were a dozen phrases between then and now that anytime you're just trying to think about other people and how to make them feel more welcome, more included, is seen as a weakness by Republicans, as a point of mockery. But kind of circling back to Tim Walz, so that clip is infuriating, right? Because Harris is doing exactly the right thing. There are people there who cannot see her, and so she gives them a verbal description. What a great thing to do, and it takes so little effort from her to include so many people into that moment, and that Republicans would choose to mock it is really telling. But again, I think when we see this Walz talk, when he talks about being a teacher, when he talks about his work including gay, lesbian, in the gay lesbian, I'm forgetting what the club was that he founded, but including LGBTQ students, certainly as a parent of a disabled child. But here he is, he's the coach. He's, he's no nonsense. He's pushing people forward, but he's very clear that everyone is welcome and everyone gets supported and everyone has a place.
To your point, the LA Times, this just came up on my phone. It's great timing. The LA Times has a piece called Tim Walz was a staunch LGBTQ plus ally long before it was common. This piece by Kevin Rector says, in a video intended to help introduce Tim Walz to a national audience, a handful of students from his years as a high school teacher sang his praises. For Jacob Wrighton, Tim Walz was the teacher who had his back against bullies during one of the most difficult chapters of his teenage life. When he came out as gay just before his senior year of high school a quarter century ago in 1999, he's now 42, and he said, when I decided to come out as gay, we started the Gay Straight Alliance. Tim Walz was the faculty advisor. I mean, this was back in 1999.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows you that he is who he is, right? That the person he's presenting to the nation comes from a real point of authenticity. That when he was a public school teacher in 1999, he was not thinking about, being on TV in 2024, giving this speech to the nation, to the world, right? He was just trying to do what he thought was the right thing. And I got to tell you that I didn't know that story in 2018 when he ran for governor. Maybe it was out there, maybe it wasn't. But that was not a story that crossed my radar. And I do, as you might expect, pay a lot of attention to the news. And I've been thrilled to hear that story and so many other things besides that have come out as he's reached this moment of national, national importance, but sort of national vetting, people looking at him with a whole different kind of lens. He just seems to really stand up.
In a video on Wednesday night, Gwen Walz, Tim Walz's wife, talked about Tim teaching for 15 years and helping lead the school's football team to state championship. She said he agreed to be this Gay Straight Alliance advisor because he knew how impactful it would be to have a football coach involved and that he inspired his students and changed lives. The LA Times reports that after Walz was elected to Congress in 2006, he continued his LGBTQ plus allyship, supporting the right to same-sex marriage, which was not affirmed nationally until a Supreme Court ruling in 2015. He also called for the repeal of the federal Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which forced gay and lesbian service members to hide their sexuality or face removal from the military. And then as governor, he signed an executive order protecting trans people's access to gender-affirming healthcare in Minnesota. He also signed two laws. One bans debunked conversion therapy practices aimed at changing or suppressing a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. The other protects trans people and their families from out-of-state subpoenas, arrest warrants, and extradition requests related to their receiving gender-affirming care in Minnesota. Wow, I didn't even know that existed. People are being subpoenaed over this?
I can't tell you. I know all the details of that. But it certainly seems clear that when presented with a new issue to him, an issue he was not as aware of or not as active of, his moral compass leads him in the right direction. And not just sort of because he has good instincts, but because he figures out who to talk to and who to listen to and who to get the information from, and then makes good decisions.
Well, we're going to take a quick break on today's Your Call. We are talking about the record of Governor Tim Walz. Last night, he introduced himself to the country by focusing on the highlights of his progressive record. What are your thoughts? What do you think this choice says about what Kamala Harris would do if she wins in November? What does this say about the future of the Democratic Party? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by David Perry, a journalist and associate director of undergraduate studies in history at the University of Minnesota. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's Media Roundtable, we will discuss media coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Speakers addressed so many important issues, including abortion rights and the right to unionize. Thousands of anti-war protesters marched outside of the convention, demanding an end to Israel's military assault on Gaza and U.S. arms sales to Israel. In fact, we'll bring you an update about what is happening. A number of delegates have met with high levels of the Democratic National Convention officials, and they said, we really would like a Palestinian speaker to speak on stage. According to the Uncommitted Movement, they gave names, they gave transcripts, and they got a call and they said no. And so they were standing, or I should say doing a sit-in right outside the convention last night. And so there's a lot of talk on social media right now about what could possibly happen. And I just saw a tweet from Jamie Gengel at CNN that there's a block in the schedule tonight that will occupy, and what will occupy that block is only known by a very small group of planners. So who knows what's going to happen? But we'll play a couple clips later in the show about the latest on that. If you would like to join today's Your Call, what are your thoughts about what you've heard so far at the convention? If you saw Tim Walz last night, what did you think of his speech? What message is Kamala Harris sending by choosing Tim Walz? She had a number of choices and she chose the most progressive one. So what does that tell you? What do you think this says about the future of the Democratic Party? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we're joined by David Perry, a journalist who has written about Tim Walz. He's also associate director of undergraduate studies in history at the University of Minnesota. It would have been so interesting, David, to hear the conversation between Tim Walz and Kamala Harris, because you know she's sending a message by choosing him. And you just wonder, I asked you this last night and I asked you on the show last time. First of all, what message do you think she's sending? And are they going to work really hard to try to bring these very popular policies that are now in Minnesota to every state across the country?
Well, I definitely know that the kinds of policies that Walz has been supporting at least are going to have a seat at the table, right? And if with a hopeful President Harris, and that's a big step. But Walz is also someone who can. I've been thinking about what Walz brings to Harris. Walz brings these policies in, but he's also someone who can take Harris's ideas and bring them into places where she maybe not so much can't go, but doesn't go. She is not a rural American. She's also not obviously a white American, and race is part of it, but it's not the only part of it. Walz comes from a very different economic kind of life, a very different educational kind of life. I loved when we were on a couple weeks ago with Will Bunch from the Philadelphia Inquirer talking about public education, and not just big name public education. You know, I work at a flagship public university, but these branch campuses, these small public universities where he went, where he works, I mean, where he got his master's, the kind of places where most of his students probably ended up going to college. He's going to be able to not just say to her, hey, this is what that part of the world looks like. But he's also going to take her ideas and bring them into his world, bring them into rural America, bring them into white America, bring them into kind of the football locker room and say, these are why you should care about these things. This is how it will make your life better. This is why it matters. So I don't want to, as much as I like the idea of sort of the Walz policies becoming the Harris policies, that sounds great. But I also like the idea of Walz carrying Harris's policies into middle America.
Hmm. Well, it seems like he's really trying to do that. And that's another reason why she chose him. If we can believe some of the reports coming out about the conversations that they had behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, would he like to be president? I don't know. I was wondering if he was going to run for president the next cycle that there was an open primary, because he's been so successful. But he doesn't seem to have those kinds of ambitions. There's no sign previously that he was really thinking of himself as a national politician. He also, you know, one of the things about being a coach and a teacher both is that it's about supporting other people. It's about seeing them thrive. It's about seeing them succeed. And that doesn't mean he can't take center stage. He's certainly done that in Minnesota a lot, but he always is willing to share that stage. He's always willing to, you know, sort of hype up other people. And I think that makes him a great vice president. He may chafe less in that role than some more ambitious people have in the past.
What about, I know that Tim Walz's progressive policies really impacted people across the board, especially low-income people, for certain policies. But what else can you tell us about Tim Walz and low-income people in Minnesota? Did he specifically talk about that? Because a lot of people are saying that the Democrats need to get beyond this middle-class talk. What does that even mean anymore? I mean, so many people are struggling to make ends meet. The Poor People's Campaign says that poor people want to be called poor and low-wage workers. And Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, who we've had on the show, he wrote a book called White Poverty with the Reverend Dr. William Barber. And he tweeted, I've heard some great speeches at the DNC this week, but I have not heard anyone like Pam on the main stage. Pam Garrison is just talking about how so many poor people feel abandoned, how no one talks directly to them. And Jonathan tweeted, a campaign that puts workers first would be wise to let a low-wage worker speak to the 34 million eligible low-income voters who did not vote in 2020. So what about Tim Walz and the poor community of Minnesota?
Yeah, I mean, I think when Walz really talks about this, it's not that he doesn't focus on poverty. He certainly has, although there's some disagreement about how our unhoused population has been supported or not supported and who's to blame for that. Mm-hmm. He certainly put a lot of emphasis behind housing and services for the unhoused community. He likes to talk about working families. I don't know if he talks as much about poverty. That's not something I've sort of had my ear tuned to. He likes to talk about working families. He likes to talk about being a union member. He likes to talk about the ways to make sure that people who do work can support themselves and support their families and live in dignity. And that's really where a lot of his message has been. So raising minimum wages across the board in Minnesota in all kinds of different ways. And that, again, you know, I talked about how there's a fee that I used to, that my family has to use to pay in order to access my son's services. And that fee is gone. So that helps, really helps middle class and upper middle class families like mine. But there's also the people who get paid to do direct care work, which is just an enormously growing industry of underpaid workers who often can't support themselves. That minimum wage, I think, and I could be wrong about this, I think it's gone up to $21 an hour as of this January, but it's certainly somewhere in that range, which is starting to get us a lot closer to a living wage, right? That's just in Minnesota. But it's said that these people who do these essential jobs who are not being paid a living wage, that needs to change, that it can change, that it can be, it can change not just by asking people, but by making it legally required to do so.
Right. Yeah, I just found the article from the Minnesota Daily. So there's a bill that would increase the minimum wage to $20 by the year 2028.
I think that's the overall minimum wage. I'm pretty sure that my direct care support worker, my son's aid, it's higher, but I could be wrong about that. We just are doing his annual budget right now.
Okay.
So I'm speaking to you as a dad with a spreadsheet in front of me, as opposed to as a well-informed journalist on this. Right. So I could be wrong.
Okay.
But I really do have a spreadsheet right here.
Well, today we're talking about the Democratic National Convention, the future of the Democratic Party. We're talking about Tim Walz's speech last night. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Lois, I wanted to mention Walz's political background. Walz is part of the progressive Paul Wellstone's legacy. Tim Walz was one of the first to benefit from the Camp Wellstone that the Wellstone family founded to bring new voices into the political arena and provide the necessary training on Wellstone's tragic death. Yes, thank you so much for that, Lois. Let's take a few callers, and then we will ask our guest, David, to respond. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. A couple of things. One, I'm glad to hear you bring up this issue of disability. I happen to be disabled, but I just want to deal with that a little bit later. But I'm glad.
Sorry, Greg, can you speak up just a bit?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
A little bit better, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Just a couple of things. I'm glad Walz is on the ticket, and I hope they can push what he's doing in Minnesota. But issues that I haven't heard too much about yet are things like poverty that you've mentioned, the environment. I hope that I'd love to see Harris do a complete 180 on Gaza and just tell the people that we've got to get this over. We have to get a ceasefire and we have to stop it. So, people are in favor of that. I agree with them 100%, but I'd like to hear them talk about these other issues. With regard to disability, I just want to say one thing. I'm disabled, and I have to struggle with my local community where I live in Palo Alto around the issues of the ADA. And you're right when you quote that statistic. The CDC says that they think that at a minimum, 1 in 4 Americans have some form of disability. But this hardly gets any coverage, and it's deplorable. I mean, I don't think that people who are gay or trans, whatever, they get an incredible amount of coverage. But the number of disabilities, they just dwarf the number of people who fall into that category. There's only 7% who identify as gay or trans, et cetera, in this country. There are, like I said, over 40 million people who are disabled. So it's a struggle even with the ADA to get reasonable accommodations in this country. I will just say, give you one experience. I did talk with a couple of years ago with a disability rights organization in the San Francisco Bay Area about an ADA issue. And they told us that eventually they often, most of the time, they have to sue. They have to litigate, go to court to get enforcement. So this is an issue that just does not get the kind of coverage it deserves.
Yeah, thank you for that, Greg. And you're right. We're going to do a lot more shows about all issues relating to people with disabilities and how difficult it is in this country and what needs to change. So we really appreciate your call and your calls on a regular basis, Greg. It's always great to hear from you. Thank you so much. I'm glad you brought up the climate, Greg, because climate hasn't gotten that much attention. Speakers have definitely mentioned it, but it's definitely not been highlighted. And this is really interesting. Democracy Now! Had an Ojibwe lawyer on the show. She's been on our show too, Tara Hauska, who was arrested in Minnesota trying to stop Line 3. And she was sent to jail. She was put in a cage. It was a horrible experience. She said she's still dealing with the trauma. I don't know if you've covered this at all, David, or you know much about this. Can you comment on this? And if you can't, that's fine. We'll do some, you know, shows about this in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Wall's record on environment has been somewhat, I guess, ambivalent, that he's done a lot of great stuff around renewable energy. He certainly talks a lot about environmental action. But this issue of Line 3 and the ways in which the state government has not taken, has allowed it to go forward, and the arrest of protesters has been one of the real blemishes. And again, you know, as I said the first time, if you had asked me where I was on Walls in 2022, I would have been generally positive, happy to have a Democratic governor, but that would have been one of the places where I would have said, you know, this has been a real problem, and it's still a real problem, although the great, so the transformative legislative session of the last year has made me feel a lot less ambivalent overall. But it definitely is. It's a space where, you know, one of the real challenges, I think, of a future Democratic administration is, are they willing to do things that are going to be hard, that are challenging to wealth and power and industry in the ways that we all know have to take place if we're going to ameliorate the worst impacts of climate change. And I guess I'm not 100% certain that Walls is ready, and I'm not 100% certain that Harris is ready. I don't think we can, you know, we can't just build renewable energy our way out of this. We have to also stop certain kinds of other things.
And to that point, and again, thanks to Democracy Now! For this, I'm reading from their site right now. Climate activists are at the convention this week to demand Democrats do more to address the climate catastrophe and divest from fossil fuels. On Wednesday, activists disrupted an event by Punchbowl News on the sidelines of the DNC that was sponsored by ExxonMobil. A delegate from California, R.L. Miller, said, "I'm here because Exxon lied and people died." And then the protesters started screaming, "Exxon lies, people die." So that was a sideline event sponsored by ExxonMobil at the Democratic National Convention. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow. Thanks again for calling in, Greg. Let's go to another caller, Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm a 64-year-old and a grandson of a Holocaust survivor from Dachau, Germany. And in 1945, the world said never again. It's happening in Israel. It's a genocide. And I was disheartened when I heard the crowd several times when Joe Biden was speaking, saying, "We love you, Joe." And I wonder if they understand that Joe could stop this genocide with one phone call, the same as Ronald Reagan did, the same as Eisenhower did, the same as George Herbert Walker Bush did, when he told Israel, "You either stop this or there's going to be no more weapons, no more loan guarantees." And it happened. 5 minutes later, 20 minutes later, Menachem Begin called Reagan and said, "It's done." But all we're hearing is that they're negotiating, and yet we've got so much leverage, so much power over this colony, and nothing seems to happen. So I think it's dishonesty. I think it's absurd, and it's very disappointing. And it's a big stain, a dark stain on the legacy of Joe Biden. And it's shameful that this country is complicit in these war crimes. It's a violation of the Leahy Act that if humanitarian aid can't get through, and it's not, that we're continuing to supply the weapons. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to do a show about all of this next week. Right now, I just want to play a couple clips just to give an update of what is happening on these issues at the DNC. So first of all, a couple of hostage family members' parents spoke last night. Rachel Goldberg Polin and John Polin, American-Israeli parents whose son Hirsch was abducted by Hamas from that music festival during the attack on October 7th, spoke last night, and they have no idea if their son is still alive. Here is John Polin.
In an inflamed Middle East, we know the one thing that can most immediately release pressure, and bring calm to the entire region. A deal that brings this diverse group of 109 hostages home and ends the suffering of the innocent civilians in Gaza. The time is now.
Hirsch, if you can hear us, we love you. Stay strong. Survive.
Bring them home.
That's Rachel Goldberg Pollan and John Pollan, American Israeli parents whose son Hirsch was abducted by Hamas from that music festival on October 7th. Palestinians say, delegates say that they have been in talk with the highest levels of government about welcoming a Palestinian on stage. They said they got a phone call yesterday and the answer was no. Prem Thakur with The Intercept just tweeted, as the DNC refuses to welcome a Palestinian on stage, members of Congress, a hostage family member, and now the UAW have come out against the decision. Uncommitted says members will continue their sit-in and encourages any officials, delegates, press, Americans to visit and hear from them. And this is a clip from Abbas Alawai, who is a Democratic delegate from Michigan.
Hello, everyone. It's 2:10 a.m. My name is Abbas Alawi. I'm an uncommitted delegate from Michigan. I'm also one of the leaders of the Uncommitted National Movement. We've been making a request of the Democratic National Convention for a Palestinian American to speak from this stage. We talked to members of Congress. We talked to party leaders. We told them all we need a Palestinian American to speak from this stage. And we were negotiating with the Democratic Party. We're telling them, hey, here's a long list of Palestinian Americans you can choose from. And they said, okay, we're considering it. We can't tell you yes, but we also are not telling you no, and that's a good thing. A few hours ago, they called and said, I have an answer for you. The answer is no. And that was all they said. We think that's unacceptable. We think that this is the party where we shouldn't be silencing people's voices, even when we have disagreements about policy. And so we sat right here, me and my fellow delegate, who ran out of options on the inside. So we're standing here on the outside, leaning into our power as regular, everyday people and asking you to join us in asking the party. We need to see a Palestinian American speaker from this stage. Today, Thursday, is the last day of the convention. They need to add someone to the program immediately. I have my phone on. It's being charged. I'm waiting for the call from the DNC. They know about this. The vice president and her team know about this. The president and his team know about this. We're waiting to hear from them. Hopefully, they'll take the opportunity to unite our party and make sure that there's room for a Palestinian American from the stage. Please join us.
That was Abbas Alawai, who is a Democratic delegate from Michigan. This morning, Keith Ellison, who is the Attorney General of Minnesota, tweeted a Palestinian American sharing his or her story, calling for a ceasefire and a release of all hostages, and calling everyone to support the ticket against fascism would be powerful. So we don't know if things are going to change. We'll find out what happens today. David, any thoughts on this? Because we know the uncommitted movement is pretty big, especially in Minnesota.
Yeah, well,
in Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan. But I was tuned in yesterday early, and I happened to catch Keith Ellison's remarks, which I might easily have missed because it's a long night. And I thought, that tweet I think is important. But I was also interesting. His remarks yesterday was the key thing he said is that Harris and Walz are listening to the uncommitted voices. They're listening to that he feels like they're listening to him, that they are listening to try to get to a ceasefire. Now, listening is just not sufficient. I think it's a mistake to not have a Palestinian American speaker, but I don't know if that's going to change. But I will say that Ellison is not someone who is in the habit of speaking nicely and saying things he doesn't believe. And so I was actually encouraged yesterday that he felt listened to. Certainly he knows Tim Walz. He knows where he works. They must have a good dialogue. It's a long way from Ellison feeling listened to any substantive change in Gaza. But maybe at least maybe very much maybe a Harris Walz administration will work harder. But it would be nice to see that change start tonight.
And we should say over 40,000 Palestinians have been killed. There have been a lot of protests, obviously outside of the convention, a few inside, people holding up a banner saying end U.S. arms to Israel. And we will continue to bring you more information about what happens. Will the Democratic National Committee allow a Palestinian to speak? Here's a tweet from J Street. This is, well, they call themselves a political home for pro-Israel, pro-peace, pro-democracy Americans. And they write, striking a tone of nuance and balance on Israel-Palestine is always a challenge. Hosting a Palestinian speaker would have been a powerful way to underscore the shared goal of an immediate ceasefire and hostage deal and the compassion the party feels for Palestinians and Israelis. That's coming straight from J Street. So we're going to follow this and see if the Democratic Party and the Democratic Convention allows a Palestinian to take the stage today. Final thoughts before we let you go, David, about where we are right now and where we might be going. We've got about a minute left.
The one thing we haven't talked about is kind of walls and masculinity, right? There's all these people, masculinity is on the ballot, all these different kinds of things. I just want to say that Tim Walz is the kind of man I try to be. I know a lot of people like him, you know, Midwestern American men. And it's nice to see that kind of persona on stage as opposed to, say, Donald Trump.
I hate to laugh, but I needed a laugh. I was just thinking about Hulk Hogan ripping off his shirt and the message
exactly.
That's supposed to send. I mean, it couldn't be more different. Well, and also the other thing is, again, we know the bar is low, but I think this stuff is really important. Kamala Harris did not take Doug Emhoff's name. That's a first. Kamala Harris does not have, she has stepchildren. She does not have her own children. That'll be a first. I mean, it's just taken this country so long to get to this point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love Doug Emhoff yesterday too, right? These are good men who have complicated, wonderful families. And what could be better?
And Doug Emhoff absolutely supporting his wife, Kamala Harris, dropping his job to support his wife. I mean, that's refreshing given what we're seeing from the masculinity on the Trump side. David Perry is a journalist and associate director of undergraduate studies and history at the University of Minnesota. As always, David, thank you so much for joining us again.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And if you're listening on KALW, be sure to tune in for our coverage tonight at 6. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.